Welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Senior Editor Kelly Davio. In March 2020, a number of products, including insulin, will transition from regulation under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act to regulation under the Public Health Service Act. That means that these products will become biologics and that subsequent entry versions will be biosimilars rather than follow-on biologics. Recently, 10 months before these products make their transition, the FDA held a hearing about biosimilar insulins. The hearing was set against a backdrop of rising concern about the skyrocketing cost of insulin in the United States and the need for cost-saving biosimilar options. Among the experts who provided testimony to the FDA was Stephen Lucio. He's the Associate Vice President of Clinical Solutions and Pharmacy Program Development at Vizient. He's also a member of the Center for Biosimilars Advisory Board. We caught up with Stephen after the public hearing to discuss biosimilar insulin, the newly released FDA guidance on interchangeability, and milestones to watch as we approach the 2020 changeover for transition products. Good morning, Stephen. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Not So Different.
Thank you very much. It's great to be able to speak with you today.
So you recently testified during the FDA's public meeting on biosimilar insulins. For people who couldn't attend that meeting, could you give a quick recap of your points?
Sure, absolutely. Again, we were attempting to articulate the needs, the approach for the regulation of biosimilars for the insulin molecules. And that's something we feel very strongly about, because it's such a need from a cost standpoint and also from the circumstance of the number of patients that take insulin. So FDA was asking for feedback about if there were any novel considerations that really needed to be taken into account with the insulin product specifically, anything that would be potentially different from other molecules, other biologics that are regulated now as biosimilars. And our perspective was the fact that there really did not need to be anything unique, that FDA should apply the same standards for evaluating biosimilars or interchangeable biologics of insulins that they have to other categories of biologics that have been approved to date. And the reason that we mention that is because really, if you look at the insulin molecules, they are, while complicated, not as complex perhaps as some of the agents that we've already had approved as biosimilars. And the key principles of the biosimilar paradigm, like the analytical characterization, extrapolating across multiple indications, assessing PK/PD data, all of those things that have been used successfully in the regulation of biosimilars already that are in existence apply directly to insulin. So we articulated that there were not any additional considerations that needed to be taken into account. The products that have the insulins lend themselves very well to what FDA has already established as the infrastructure for regulating and approving biosimilars.
And in your testimony, you said that you believe that molecules that are necessary to create insulin are particularly well suited to having biosimilar options. Why is that?
Because it's very well suited, because the molecules can be characterized, and they also, the other important point is that they are so heavily used in clinical practice. One of the things that the insulins are so well designed to be able to be considered as biosimilars is the fact that they carry the same characteristics as biologic products. Molecules where we understand the molecular structure, where we can identify the key elements that identify a product that is highly comparable, highly similar. You, with insulins, know how the molecules work. You can assess their efficacy and the safety considerations. And so because of that, all the infrastructure that exists for the insulin products is very well suited for the circumstances that FDA has created to regulate these medications. The other reason why it is so critically important was We provided some information to FDA regarding the price forecasting that we do here at Vizient. Twice a year, we publish a document called our drug price forecast that examines trends in pricing that we think is going to happen for the next 6 to 18 months. And some of the information we shared was the fact that even though many insulins have been around in some cases in excess of a decade and a half or close to 20 years, the overall pricing behavior is acting very similar to more novel therapeutic categories where the molecules are still in their first iteration of market exclusivity and patent protection. And so for a therapeutic class that has been around for a long time to be seen pricing to follow and trend in a similar fashion to what we have for more novel therapeutic categories, again, it's exactly the type of therapeutic product category that we would want to target for a biosimilar. So given the molecular characteristics, the behavior of these products, as well as their impact on drug spend and what we're seeing as their influence on what payers and even more importantly, patients are having to pay in order to get these therapies, this all lends itself to being very appropriate for the biosimilar pathway to address and provide additional competition.
Let's also talk about interchangeable biosimilars. So the FDA finalized that interchangeability guidance just ahead of the public meeting on insulin. How much clarity did that guidance give to stakeholders about interchangeable products in general and interchangeable insulins in particular?
Yes, the final guidance was very much appreciated and extremely welcome. And in fact, I had to change my comments because that was one of the initial things that we were going to ask. We were asking FDA to finalize that guidance for interchangeability. And the fact that they did was something that we applauded and encouraged FDA and thanked them for taking that step. Because even though the guidance is written in a reasonably broad fashion, which is appropriate, it still, since it was in a draft format, left uncertainty for many of the stakeholders in the market. So whether you were potentially a manufacturer looking to understand what it would take to get that interchangeability designation, that creates uncertainty. And then for actual providers and clinicians and prescribers, really not understanding what interchangeability is going to comprise, it just creates additional uncertainty, which does not help the overall adoption and uptake of biosimilars. And so the fact that we now have a final guidance, and so the things that FDA had articulated are now specifically characterized, helps alleviate some of that consideration. One of the things that was very helpful for the entirety of biosimilar potential was the fact that FDA agreed to allow the utilization of non-U.S. originator data in the interchangeability process if the sponsor could deem it appropriate. So the use of data related to non-U.S. originator products is something that we've seen used with the biosimilars that have been launched to date, and that has worked fine. And so also allowing that potential additional level of efficiency in the interchangeability designation was very helpful. And so I think that will continue to drive efficiencies and opportunities to maximize, again, the expedited process by which biosimilars, including insulin biosimilars, can be approved. So overall, it was very important for that to take place, again, to begin addressing that residual uncertainty about what interchangeability means. Now, to that end, one of the things we commented to FDA that is still important is that there remains a high degree of uncertainty, not about what it takes to get interchangeability, but what interchangeability actually means. And if you talk to different constituents, for example, physicians, they're mostly concerned about the feeling of being disintermediated in the prescribing process. And if you talk to the supplier community, they're concerned about to what extent interchangeability will make a product more likely to be utilized than a non-interchangeable biologic. And one of the things that I brought up was the fact that there still is potentially a consideration that somehow non-interchangeable biosimilars are potentially inferior to interchangeable biologics. And so why this is so important is because within the insulin marketplace, this is a circumstance where interchangeability and substitution considerations are likely to be more influential, unlike biosimilars such as Inflectra and Renflexis that are administered by a healthcare provider, or ultimately what will come in a few years, biosimilars to Humira, drugs like that, which are delivered and administered through a specialty pharmacy. Insulins are, in fact, something that you frequently get in a retail setting. And so understanding what a physician intends is critically important for a pharmacist, because they don't have as easy of an access to the physicians as compared to some a pharmacist working in a specialty pharmacy or in a health system, et cetera. So it is important, I think, not only that the guidance is finalized, which is great, but for FDA to continue to move forward and provide additional education to help all these stakeholders understand what interchangeability really means. That just because a biosimilar is not interchangeable, it's not inherently inferior, and then addressing and alleviating concerns of prescribers, of physicians, that just having this designation doesn't eradicate their potential to still designate a branded or originator product as desired. So again, we made some progress in terms of being able to have a final guidance, but there's still more work that needs to be done in helping bring about the interchangeable perspective as it relates to biosimilars.
Given the fact that, as you say, many insulins are dispensed to the patient in the retail pharmacy setting, how do you feel about the FDA's recently updated guidance concerning the naming of biosimilars and the fact that we'll continue to have these four-letter meaningless suffixes that are appended to the names of biosimilars, but not to the names of the originator products?
That is a great question. And even though FDA did not specifically ask for feedback in this hearing, we gave it anyway. And one of the points we made is that we continue to disagree with the strategy of using a devoid of meaning suffix for biosimilars and for biologics, because it does not convey any additional information. One of the circumstances we've been grappling with is trying to find any other situation in healthcare where an abbreviation or some type of suffix or prefix is meaningless. You know, the regulatory perspective, accreditation organizations really have required a great deal of consideration about how any types of abbreviations or identifiers are used to avoid confusion. And thus far, the presence of the suffixes that have been assigned to the biosimilars that have been approved and now to the novel originators that are being licensed really has either been ignored completely or just not even recognized. And so we, again, articulated to FDA that we really would request their revisiting this process. And if it is deemed that a suffix is truly necessary, which we do not believe it is, given other identifiers such as the National Drug Code, the information regarding lot, expiration date, and now the serialization that is being required based upon the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act, that there are enough identifiers that already exist. We don't need an additional one, much less one that is pretty much has any meaning eliminated from it. And so if FDA still was feeling that there was some necessity to have some additional identifier, we would say they'll at least make it meaningful and make it somehow convey something about the product. And then if you're going to do it, then have it consistent for all biologics and not have this confusing circumstance where it's only for biosimilars and for new originators, but not previously licensed originator branded products. From our membership, which is pretty much, again, has been conveyed, is that, again, we have yet to have one member organization tell us that they approve of that methodology. And as I alluded to, many are right now just choosing not to utilize that designation in any fashion and are relying on things such as the proprietary name that the biosimilars have adopted and associated with their products.
So as we look ahead to 2020 and the transition of some products to standing as biologics and biosimilars, what does the market today for follow-on insulins tell us about how easy or how hard it's going to be for those biosimilars to gain traction?
I think it tells us that there's a much needed opportunity, and we have seen reasonably good uptake of competitors such as to the Basaglar product, in terms of competing with Lantus. And so there definitely is a need, and I think it's also going to be product specific. I think there are certain agents that where it's been more an interesting consideration for, given the patient usage, given the market share for products. I think there's certain molecules, certain versions of insulin that are going to drive greater uptake just because the demand is so substantial. One of the areas that I think will continue to be interesting to follow as we go forward is to what extent the originator companies derive even other formulations of their product to keep them differentiated from potential competition. And that is something that will make this insulin landscape somewhat complicated. For some of the biosimilars that we've seen approved, it's been relatively straightforward because the originator, for example, only comes in a vial, and it's not that hard to replicate a vial. But since insulin, although it can be administered by a healthcare provider, is very much a patient-directed experience, then the other complicating factor is the fact that you will have different presentations, different dosage forms. And so definitely all people who are interested in having competition need to be cognizant of that, because people not only obviously desire the clinical impact of insulins, but the way in which they're able to access and administer that medication is critically important. So this is going to be a market very much driven by the patient care experience, the direct personalization of the therapies and the formulations. And so obviously the biosimilar companies are going to have to make sure that their technologies, whatever presentations they have, are at least as convenient to use as what the originator provides. And so there is a huge opportunity for pharmacists, for the certified diabetic educators, for nurses, for all the people that help patients manage their disease state, to be comfortable to educate them on these variations in not obviously not in the molecule, but in the presentations, to ensure that, again, people can maximize the therapy and hopefully, again, in doing so, get a lower expense and have a lower pressure in terms of the cost of their medications.
And as we get closer and closer to March 2020 and the transition of insulin products and some of the other products that are going to be covered under the deemed to be a license provision, are there any key milestones that stakeholders should be watching in the coming months?
Well, definitely as we get closer to March of next year, it's going to be very important to look and see what happens to the applications that are already in the queue, for example, because FDA in its guidance talked about the March 23rd, 2020 timeframe, the elements that will happen right on that date and then subsequently after. And so it's going to be interesting to see if any suppliers continue to try and get licensing before that transition, or if they're just going to work with FDA and wait, or if FDA is going to, just wait until after the 2020 timeframe to begin approving these iterations, these versions of the insulin product. So definitely the next few months will be very important watching to see what happens and how people continue to respond to these, updated guidances that have been published and what's going to transpire in the market. There are obviously other deemed to be licensed molecules, without question, given the scope of the use, whether it's the number of prescriptions written, the patients receiving medication, the cost of the agents, insulins are the biggest target. So in one circumstance, it's great that we're dealing with potentially the most complex group of products, but also they're going to be, complex because there's so many different versions of insulins. And so that's going to be a key element for, again, maintaining that vigilance to know what is transpiring, when products come into existence, even, some before this deadline or after the deadline, if we start to see a high influx of biosimilars for the insulin products. And so there's a great opportunity for education. And so again, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, need to be very vigilant so they know how to begin articulating these opportunities to their patients and being able to educate them on what it actually means. And so you can be guaranteed the providers are going to be looking at this, the payers are going to be looking at this. And so it's critically important for clinicians to be able to understand what they need to do, what actions they need to take, gearing up towards this transition period. One of the things that we continue to convey to FDA, and it's not something that they've taken action on, but something that we feel would be very helpful, is that as we continue to engage physicians particularly, there still remains a lack of understanding about some of the basics of biologic manufacturing. And one of the elements we've still been encouraging our members and our physician, our pharmacist colleagues to communicate is the fact that biosimilars and the way in which they're regulated, even though that the specifics of that infrastructure are new, the concept of variability of biologic products is not new, because branded drugs over their life cycles, branded biologics go through manufacturing changes, and there are key elements that FDA has in place for the manufacturers to demonstrate that there's no difference in an originator biologic before or after a change occurs. And so really what we're doing is taking that concept and applying it to biologic molecules that are manufactured by a different supplier. One of the things that is very interesting in Europe is that they disclose that information about manufacturing changes for the branded biologics. That information is not made available here in the United States in any fashion. It's not publicly disclosed. And so in this hearing that occurred, and in some previous hearings, and in the written information that we submitted to FDA, we continue to make the request that to some extent, FDA be more transparent and allow for some disclosure of that manufacturing change as it recurs and as it relates to the branded biologics. Because we believe that if that was more visible, that would help also allay concerns about this process of biosimilarity, and clinicians, particularly physicians, hopefully would understand that, again, the principles are very similar between what is in place for biosimilars as well as what happens with the branded originators over the course of their life cycle. So there still remains a lot of work to help people understand the relevance, the importance of manufacturing, and what its impact is truly on the biologic that you actually get and you actually administer, prescribe, and deliver to patients. And so that's one thing that we always include in our comments, and we continue to hope that FDA will take action and that it will just help address the overall lack of awareness that I think resides within the clinical practice landscape. It is not something that is novel just to biosimilars. If we're looking at compounded medications or we're looking at other aspects of the manufacturing process, it's critically important, and I think is becoming even more important for, you know, end users, clinicians, to understand what goes into manufacturing steps and how critical it is for all pharmaceuticals, not just biosimilars. So that is something that we've, again, conveyed to FDA, and we're continuing to communicate it. Hopefully, at some point, we can get a little bit more insight in terms of what transpires with the originator products.
Well, thank you, Stephen, so much for your time this morning. I really appreciated talking to you and hearing your insights.
Thank you so much. It's been great speaking with you, and we continue to convey the importance of biosimilars, and I think we're continuing to make progress to that type of value opportunity for everyone, and especially for the patient populations that are served by many of our members.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Not So Different. To read more about transition products, visit our show notes. Remember, if you like the podcast, rate us at iTunes. Until next time, visit us at centerforbiosimilars.com.